Blog Talk Radio.
Research at the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. I want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. All of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. Well, there comes a point in our genealogy research where you just cannot seem to get the information you're seeking. Either it's because it's not there, or you think it's not there, or because for one reason or another, there may be a family secret, a secret that perhaps may be too painful to repeat. Well, my guest tonight will take you on a genealogical journey to find the truth. Charles Brown is the president of the St. Louis African American History and Genealogy Society. He was born and raised in the Carondelet neighborhood of South St. Louis City and attended Northeast Missouri State University. His strong religious foundation was rooted in the Quinn Chapel AME Church. He retired as a coach and educator and began to help organize a family reunion on his paternal side. This genealogical journey had a lot of secrets, hidden agendas, and valuable history. And I will let my guest share with you what he discovered. Now, the format for tonight is going to be a little different because this is going to be an opportunity for Charles to really unravel this secret in the way that's comfortable for him. Therefore, I will not be asking him any questions right now. Now, chatters, I really would appreciate having you share with us questions and just put those questions in the chat room. And at the break, we'll come back and we'll ask some of those questions. So let me give a warm welcome to Charles Brown, Jr. to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Charles, are you online?
Hello, Bernice. How are you?
I'm fine. Could you just speak up just a little?
Certainly.
Okay. Well, Charles, I said I wasn't going to ask you any questions, but I want you just to help describe your research journey and just take us on that journey that you went through.
Okay. In 2000, I knew absolutely nothing about my family. In 2001, I was up in Decatur, Illinois, and we were having a Thanksgiving feast. And the family sitting around after we ate said, why don't we have a family reunion because we don't know anybody. We don't know each other. We don't know the family. So let's take our surnames and have a family reunion. I said to them, let's not do that. Let's research our ancestors and use their names and find anybody else who's in our family that we don't know. Well, whenever you make a suggestion that sounds good, you generally buy it, so it looks like I bought it. Well, I started researching the family. My father was an only child, so I didn't think there were many people in the family. My father was deceased, so I went into a picture album that he had of family, and I started taking out pictures and looking at the back of them, and there were names. So then I started calling relatives, calling more relatives, and that took me to Obion County, Tennessee, which is where Fulton, Kentucky is, on the border between Fulton, Kentucky, and Fulton, South Fulton, Tennessee. I started gaining more family and more family and more family. So the surname that I was researching were Cobb for my great-grandfather and Bransford for my great-grandmother. In the Fulton area where most of the Cobb descendants, I mean the Bransford descendants today, where the Cobb descendants had all migrated. My particular family migrated about 1885. And as a little sidebar, doing my research about 3 years ago, I met a relative in L.A. who knew nothing about what I was doing. And he's older than I am. And he told me his mother, who was living in the area with the family, was a small lady, and she said, and excuse my French, but the family lived in Obion County, and the Klan came by and said, you white niggas need to be out of here by sunup. So they migrated from Obion County, Tennessee, to Lawrence County, Missouri, which is in the southwest portion of Missouri, not far from Springfield and not far from Joplin, where the tornado was back in May. And that's where they set up residency. They had all the family members, it was nine of them, lived in an eight-room house, and they all pooled their resources together. The two men in the household, besides my great-grandfather, worked as Pullman porters on the railroad. Well, I'm still doing my research, so I can't find anything on my great-grandfather other than him in the census record with the family. I know he left Obion County, but I couldn't find him in Pierce City in the 1900 census records. But I had a picture of him that is on the advertisement of he, his wife, and four of my aunts and uncles. And that picture was taken about 1894. So I know that he was either on the journey with them from Obion County or he was either in Missouri. My brother, I started soliciting him to help me a little bit. He was going in the Ozarks on a vacation, so I asked him to go down to the cemetery in Springfield where the family was last resided the last time I knew it. So he went to Springfield to look at headstones for me, and he had heard from my father that there was a riot down in southwest Missouri in Pierce City, and so he got a little nosy, and he went to Pierce City, and he snooped around, and he asked the people in Pierce City. Pierce City is a sundown town. A sundown town means black aren't allowed in a town after dark, and a lot of towns that's still on the records today. So with it being a sundown town, he couldn't just walk in there like he was a tourist. So he walked in there. He asked a few questions. They sent him to Monette and the editor of the newspaper in Monette called the Monette Times, and his name was Murray Bischoff. So he told him who he was. Murray said he had been doing research on the African Americans from that area after the incident. Well, my brother didn't know anything about the incident. So then Murray goes on his way, sends my brother on his way. He gets a call. My brother gets a call from Murray a week later. Murray had come to St. Louis and went down to the library, and he had found a newspaper clipping from the Post-Dispatch on the front page dated 1901 where it said, Negroes driven out of southwest Missouri town. So that started our quest towards finding more research on the family. What I did, I set up a website in Lawrence County to try to solicit anybody that had any information about this racial cleansing or any other family members from Pierce City who had been driven out, who might be able to come back and help me with this filling in the blanks or just want to help me to where we can work as a group to try to do something. So after doing this, I was contacted by an organization, a production company out of New York called Two Tones Productions. Two Tones Productions was working in conjunction with a person named Elliot Jasper. Elliot Jasper was writing a book called Buried in the Bitter Waters, which was about Pierce City and two other cities in the United States, Forsyth County, Georgia, and Harrison, Arkansas. All of these locations had documentation to prove that blacks were expelled and hung and shot at and things of that nature. So that started me on my quest to see if I can find anything on this. Elliot Jasper had hired researchers from Missouri to help him with things about Missouri. So he hired a woman to do research in Pierce City and around the surrounding areas. So she found a newspaper clipping that showed the death of my great-grandfather. He died October 1898 of dropsy, was buried from the AME church, was a good, it said, good Fort Rice and outstanding citizen, and was buried in the Pierce City Cemetery. Well, African Americans typically weren't buried in the Pierce City Cemetery. So that was great knowledge for me, but it didn't really move me because I didn't know what I could do with it. So then I came back home and I started researching family again. So I tried census records. I had them back to 1870. I tried websites. I found one called GenWebForumGenealogy.com. So what I did, I looked up the surname of my family, which was Bransford. That was the name, the maiden name of my great-grandmother. So as I get on the site, I start researching Bransfords, and I start talking to different Bransfords, and I find a Bransford in Texas. This Bransford told me by way of email and chat that she knew of the African Americans in her line of the family. She said, in fact, I have a 691-page document that my great uncle composed on the family from coming off the boat from England, and it lists all the slaves in there and information about them. She even told me she would share that with me. So she sent me the 691-page document. As I'm thumbing through the document, I see that there are three Caucasian brothers who had African-American slaves who they had children by. So I was one brother's descendant, and the relatives around Kentucky and Tennessee who had migrated to St. Louis who I knew were one other brother's family. I didn't know about the third brother. So the family that I knew was from Tennessee, from the other brother, we started conspiring and trying to figure out if we really knew anything about each other, how we were kin. We couldn't find anything. So I go back to this 691-page document, and I find John Bransford III's Bible. And on the back side of the Bible, it lists the slaves who are called in the family, so to speak, and they were all taught to read. So that told me that they weren't slaves, based on research I had done before about people who were slaves and now weren't slaves, that they couldn't be taught to read if they were still a slave. So in this document, it says that all of the slaves, there were 16 of them, were deceased at this particular time, and there was one, the youngest person, who paid $100 to his owner to stay there for hire. And this was handed down to his, to that person's siblings in 1858, and the siblings refused to take the money, but the guy had nowhere else to go. So after emancipation, they told him that he's free to go. We will not take any more money. You're not a in bondage or a part of our family anymore. Now you can move on. And that was totally horrendous to me to think that a person had nowhere to go. He was free, and he had to pay for his residence to live on this particular plantation. Then I went and I looked at one of the other brothers, and I saw the back of his Bible, and on his Bible it had my descendants. My great-grandmother, Arminta Bransford, whose picture is in the advertisement, her mother and her mother's mother, all listed on the back of Abraham Bransford's Bible. Then, after further talking to the lady in Texas, she told us that Thomas Bransford was her line of the Bransford family, and he had a slave son named Madison who was leased to the Mammoth Cave in Glasgow, Kentucky, to explore, chart, and tour the cave. Madison had a son, a grandson, and four great-grandchildren who all became tour guides at the cave. One of them, named Matt Bransford, set up a separate but equal lodge for African-Americans to go down there and tour the cave. After going down there and talking to a relative that I found down there, he was telling me about how the Bransfords were treated as a slave. They would take Caucasian people on a tour and say it was a dangerous tour, and if a person was walking freely and maybe go over the edge, he couldn't go and grab him and pull him back. So what he would do is he would make a song up. And the song that he made up was something like, if you walk too far, you go over the edge. If you go over the edge, we'll wave bye-bye to you. Something kind of silly and stupid, but it got the point across to the person, and then he would step back. So that was totally amazing to me. So that meant that all the Bransfords on all those different lines of people were now able to be added to my family tree. So then I came back to Tennessee, and I started researching the Tennessee area. Well, you know, a lot of us are very skeptical of everybody, so you have to break the ice. So what I would do is I would bring pound cake or red beans and rice or fried chicken or dinner rolls or anything to get in the home. Then I would try to convince the person that they were possibly related to me. Once I mentioned names and they mentioned names and the names were the same, they kind of trusted me a little bit more. So now I'm working on my second family reunion, which I'm going to have in Tennessee. So the second family reunion went from 100 family members at the first one to over 400 at the second one. Well, the reunion went on without a hitch. Now everybody is really fired up to express their interest in the family. So I come back down there and I spend 2 weeks. And I didn't realize how much information I could achieve in 2 weeks from these people who I had to give them a pound cake before. Now all I needed to do was a knock at the door and a smile. So I gained more valuable information on the family, more names. You know, I learned about a lot of dirt, like who married what cousin. I have one cousin who I found that she married her stepfather's brother. So that means that her father is also her brother-in-law. And I thought that was very comical and strange. But I found a lot of inbreeding, in other words, cousins married cousins. And a lot of people didn't want to talk about that. But after the reunion, they got a little more faith in me whereas those taboo things were not as taboo as they were before that time. I traveled all around the country to different areas where people told me there were family members at. I went up to a place called Plymouth, Michigan. I met a cousin in South Bend, Indiana, and he took me up to Plymouth, Michigan. While up in Plymouth, Michigan, we knock on this guy's door who he knew. Everywhere I go, I take pictures. My father collected pictures of the family, and I had been collecting pictures and taking pictures all from the time I started. So I'm in this man's home, and I'm talking to him about the family. I'm showing him pictures, and he's looking over his glasses like, yeah. So then I pull out a picture, and I said, here's a lady, and here's her son. Except, but this little guy looks to be about 8 years old in a cap. I haven't been able to find out who he is. He looked at me and he says, that's me. He said to me, why don't you go out for about an hour and maybe go get a sandwich or something and come back so I can compile all the stuff I have to give to you. Where he wasn't going to help me before, when I had pictures to show him of some of his ancestors, he pulled out everything that he had on the family from his chest. Normally when I would go around and do research, I would take a computer and a portable scanner. So that I would never take your pictures from your household. So I got about 60 to 70 pictures. So that added more pictures to my file and to my family chest. I came back home. Now I receive a phone call from a producer of a documentary named Marco Williams. Marco said that he was going to do a documentary on racial cleansing, and he wanted to include Pierce City. Well, I wasn't too excited about the idea. I didn't want to really work with him. I wasn't really into what he was going to do. So I kind of backed off and decided to just chill for a while. So then what happened, I get a call from the girl who was down in Springfield who had done the research down in Pierce City, who had found my great-grandfather, and she asked me if I'd be interested in doing something to maybe help bring this to light and bring it to a head. I said, well, I don't know if I'd really be ready to do that. I'll just have to wait and think about it. So she finally talked me into it. I went down to Springfield and I met her. She was a Caucasian lady, and she said, you know what, why don't we go to Pierce City? I told her Pierce City is not on my radar screen. Well, she finally talked me into going to Pierce City. She talked me into going up to the cemetery where my great-grandfather was buried. She had already been to the grave, and she had given them the lie that it was her great-grandfather, and they had given her the records from out of the office, and they told her to go on up to the cemetery, and we'll identify the grave where your great-grandfather is. That was the lie she told them. When I came down there, we went to the grave attendant, and we went up to this area where the grave was, and then we said, guess what? This is not her great-grandfather. It's mine. So this is an 80-year-old gentleman. He's scratching his head. He don't know what to say, you know. So I told him, I said, well, what we need to do, we need to identify the grave here. We need to identify that there is a body there before we can go on. We have the grave marker. There wasn't a grave marker on the grave. The marker was on the map that they had of the charts of all the plots. So it had Cobb there, which was the name of my great-grandfather. And so he said, I don't know what I can do about it or what we can do. I said, well, let me go home and think about it, and I'll come back in about 2 weeks, and I'll talk to you. So when I go back down there, I meet him at the cemetery, and the president of the Cemetery Association is there. Now, you know, there's not a black person for a 50-mile radius and 360 degrees. So I'm basically there by myself. So I said to her, I said, I'm looking for my great-grandfather's grave. They have these stakes down, and they have this stake that's about 8 feet away from where the grave was sited on the plot. The good thing about it was there was not a grave in front. There wasn't a grave in back. There was one to the left, but there was a row to the other side. So they told me that they didn't believe he was there and that there wasn't concrete enough evidence for them to declare that he was there. So first off, they said to me that there's a tax on any graves, and the tax is $1 a year that they've been in the grave, so that meant I had to pay it was 104 years at that time, so that meant I had to pay $104. And then they asked me if I had the deed for the cemetery plot, you know, and I had never heard that cemetery plots had existed in 1901. But anyway, I said, I'll go home and see if I can find one. So then I said, well, if I can't find any of this, maybe we can dig up the body and do DNA. And the gravedigger said, there's never going to be a grave dug up here ever in life. So I leave and go home. Marco Williams calls me again and asked me if I was considering being in a movie. And I told him, yes, now I want to be in a movie. I have something I want to do. I don't want to move up. I want to dig up my great-grandfather in Pierce City. I want to move him to Springfield where his wife is. and I want to get this done ASAP. And he said, fine, I'm with you. So he brought his camera crew down, and we went on our quest back down to Pier City. And the documentary was made. The documentary is called Banish. It tells about going down there, approaching the town not wanting to do what we wanted it to do, but they did it anyway. Then after the town did this, my family had incurred $2,600 in expenses. So I went to the coroner, who was the overseer of the whole project, and I told him basically what I need is for healing to take place in this town between this town and my family. The best way for this healing to take place is for Pier City to pay for the activities that we've done here, exhuming my great-grandfather, reinterring him, expenses for us coming down here and everything. It comes to $2,600. I think you have an attorney or a doctor who can afford $2,600 to release the town from being hostage over this deep, dark secret that has been with them over 100 years that none of us knew about. So in the film, all this is shown, and then I have a press conference after we bury my great-grandfather, and I read a statement that I had sent to the mayor, and I told the people who helped me make this happen that this was not to them. This was to the town. The mayor is the representative of the town. I didn't have no problems with them. I just wanted the town to be accountable for the things that they done 100 years ago to my family, because we did not want to come back to Pier City where black people can't even be in after the sun goes down and put a wreath on the grave or even look at the grave of my great-grandfather. So in the film, you see things leading up to the interment, up to the exhuming, along with the fallout from all of this incident. It was not pretty. It was not nice. I received threatening letters. Instead of the mayor sending a response to me, he published my name, address, and phone number in their newspaper along with the response. He put a proclamation in there. I don't know what that meant, but, you know. I advise all of you to see the film. I think it's a moving film. It will really, really hit you pretty tight. Pretty tough, and you'll see that we were strong and we persevered. We got the movement of the remains, but we did not get the satisfaction of them reimbursing us for our expenses. I told them in the letter that if they reimbursed us for our expenses, I will stand and have a press conference in the square and vindicate the town. And I guess what they did. They went to Neosho, Missouri, and they found a black man who a girl was friends with from Pier City, and they set him up in residency in Pier City. They made him a member of the Board of Aldermen. They made him a fire inspector, and they said that he was now a resident of Pier City, and they sent me a letter to that effect. And I basically tore it up and sent it back to him and said, no, doesn't work. I said, the only thing that I see that you can do is come to an area like St. Louis, recruit 20 blacks who are impoverished, bring them to Pier City, set them up in a home environment. Now you will learn how black people are. You will live around black people. You will see how it is to be around black people in a everyday environment, and then you will prove to me that you have changed. Well, not. They didn't want to do any of that.
So this is a chance for you to take a little break, and
okay,
we're going to come back in a few minutes. There's some chatting going on, and we'll give you a little break, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome back to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Bennett, and you're listening to Charles Brown Jr. share his journey of uncovering a secret in his family. Now, Charles has given us a very emotional overview of what his journey was like. And I'm opening up the chat right now for those of you who have questions. And then, Charles, we want you to continue to share with us what happened. But I do see a question right now in the chat, and it's, what is the status of things at present?
Well, nothing has changed, because what happened was there was the 104th Congress at that time, 109th Congress, I'm sorry, and a congressman from Missouri named William Lacy Clay introduced a bill in my behalf in the House of Representatives on April the 28th, 2005, and 19 congressmen signed on, but the Republicans were able to kill the bill in conference and not even really allow it to get to committee to where it could possibly get out of committee. And what it was about, in essence, was reparations for what has happened. So I know that is one thing that's going on. But as far as the headstone for my great-grandfather, we don't have one. I asked them for a headstone. The reason we haven't done it is because I think that they should at least be responsible for a headstone. He was a soldier in the colored troops in the Civil War. So I told them, all you have to do is go through the necessary paperwork and get a headstone. But their response to me was, I lied to them, I duped them, I wasn't honest, I wasn't fair, and they tried to do everything in good faith, and I wasn't following through. So we're still in the same situation we were in 2005.
Now, we have some others who wanted to know, where can they find the documentary?
Okay, in February, a lot of times PBS shows it. Whatever your PBS affiliate is, you can check the scheduling of it. If you want to purchase the movie, you can go to CaliforniaReel.com, and they offer it. I think it's a modest price of $25 per issue, and that's a student classification.
Mm-hmm. Now, another question coming out of the chat is, what type of grassroots family support did you have as you went through this journey?
Well, what I did first, I took oral history, and then I followed the census record and Ancestry.com, and I backed everything up with that. And, you know, when you do African-American research, you're going to get about 70% documentation, and you have to rely on maybe 20% oral history and 10% of gut feeling. But when I went to Wayne County, I would find, for example, James Cobb was married, and he had 7 kids. And then his oldest child had 13 kids. I got all of them listings. And then when James remarried after his wife died, he had 6 kids. And then one of his second children had another 12 kids. So that was, you can't beat that as far as documentation.
Now, did you have family members also helping you and other people in the community who were aware of what happened with the family?
No, because, you know, unless you acquire interest for it and have a purpose, my purpose was the family reunion in the beginning, and then it just caught on. But the first time I went to the 1870 census and I saw my great-grandparents and my grandparents and my grandmother, it brought a tear to my eye, and then I was hooked. Mm-hmm. So that caused me to go the extra mile and whatever it took to find something.
Well, what was the general reaction of your family when you uncovered this information?
Oh, why are you trying to uncover that mess? Mm-hmm. And the reason was that there was so much intermarrying. You know, I know of cousins who marry cousins. I know of relatives who have outside complete families that live maybe on the other side of the river or on the other side of the tracks. I had family who were living in a certain area, which is all white today, in Tennessee. I went to the genealogy society and I told the powers to be down there that my family lived here, and they said no blacks have ever lived there. And I got a postcard from a cousin in Decatur, Illinois, and I showed him the postcard that's postmarked at this little community called Pierce Station.
Mm-hmm. Now, from the time you started your research to the time you exhume your great-great-grandfather's body, how long was that?
4 years.
So obviously this whole process wasn't overnight.
Wasn't overnight, but by research standards, it was fast-track. It was pretty quick, you know. I was still finding family along the way, to whereas now, on that particular line of the family, I have 2,300 names listed on my tree. That sounds unbelievable, but I can document each one of them either by oral history, word of mouth, or by records, and I find more every day. I haven't even talked about the Caucasians who are still contacting me by way of the website that I mm-hmm. have out there.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if you go to and Google James Cobb, Lawrence County, or James William Cobb, Lawrence County, and you'll have the trailer from the movie, and you'll also have the website that I have on Roots Web out there.
Okay. Now, there is a question in the chat, and it relates to the postcard.
Yes.
What was the response when they saw the postcard?
They just shook their head and acted like I wasn't there. They walked away from me.
But there's also another question. I mean, because we're still trying to, you know, figure out. They walked away from you, yet you had the postcard that had that evidence. Well, how did the town get upset when the body was moved?
Well, originally they didn't. They thought what it was doing was closing a chapter in their dark secret until I had the press conference and I read what I wanted from the town. That's when it hit the fan, and there were threats on my life, and there were people that were very upset with me. There were articles written about me that I was a crook, I was a bad person, and that I was asking the town to do something that it couldn't do. It didn't make any sense for me to be that uppity, and that they had done everything they could in good faith, which was move a little bit of dirt, because when you open a body, a grave up after 104 years, you're not going to find much.
Right.
Oh, one thing about the grave, which raised their eyebrows when we were doing this, during that time, most coffins were just pine boxes.
Mm-hmm.
This coffin they dug up had pewter handles, pewter hinges, and a glass face. So I asked the coroner what that meant. He said a glass-faced coffin was generally reserved for special people, royalty, or someone who could afford it. And at that time, they didn't have embalming, so the glass face allowed you at the wake to still see the face without opening the casket.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is amazing. So the actual casket was still in good shape?
No, it had deteriorated because it was wood, but
oh.
It looked like pewter handles, and they retained all the handles. They retained the locks. They retained a piece of glass that was on the face, and they retained about three pieces of bone. But
when you're saying they retain, who's they?
Yes, the coroner was in charge of the whole proceedings.
Okay.
So he had a crew out there of archaeologists and grave diggers, and they dug up the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were questioning me as to where the grave was. He had a 2-foot bucket on his backhoe, and when
mm-hmm.
he made one swipe and they went down, he found the center of the grave in one swipe. So the coroner told me after that, when we were still on good terms, that we can tell just by looking at the ground, even with grass, if there's a body buried and where it is. So that explained how the person dug to the grave just from taking his backhoe and going into the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yet the cemetery caretaker said that there was that nobody would be moved. Is that
right.
correct? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When the camera's rolling, things kind of change. And they felt that they saw a way for them to look good in all of this, and I was going to end up with a little dirt, and it wouldn't matter, and wouldn't hurt them, and wouldn't mean anything. But I flipped the script on them, and that's when they got angry at me, and they couldn't understand why I wasn't truthful with them in the beginning, that I should have told them up front what my intentions were. I said, if I did, you wouldn't have done this for me.
Mm-hmm. And where was the cemetery caretaker when the body was removed?
Oh, he was the one working the backhoe. You know, he was an 80-year-old gentleman that had been working at that cemetery for over 50 years.
Oh, okay.
He worked the backhoe to exhume the body, and they had two guys work down in the hole to sift through the remains to distinguish between body remains and mud, because it was buried. He was buried on a rock,
mm-hmm.
and it was about 4.5 feet down to the bottom of the casket, so he wasn't 6 feet down. And everything was above this rock, and there was mud and mush and things of that nature there.
Now, in reality, did you expect the city to actually respond in a positive way because the cameras were rolling?
Well,
or was there some deep, deep feeling that perhaps they would not respond the way you wanted them to respond?
I was hoping that they would, and they did up until I asked them for the money. And that's when you look at the film, if you look at the film, you'll see the coroner when I explained to him what I had done by sending a letter to the mayor and that I was going to still pay him for his coffin and his portion of the proceedings, but I wanted to be reimbursed for the money that we put out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it all hit the fan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that you have this big newspaper article about what happened to the family. What year was that newspaper article written?
1901. That was 2 days after the incident, and a reporter from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in St. Louis, Missouri, took a trip down to Pierce City and covered the whole incident. We didn't know anything about this. None of our family did. Nobody talked about it. But after we got the article and retransposed it to where it could be read, there's several things that are very alarming that were in the article. One of them was it said that even suntan whites were in danger, you know, when this happened. It said that the local people, along with people from a 50-mile radius, came to town, and they went to the National Guard Armory. They checked out the weapons from the armory, and they went and stood in front of the area, which was the black community, and they all shot like they were in battle. Then it says in the article that our home had over 250 bullet holes in it of where they shot. And then they interview my great-grandmother, and she talks about how Kentucky was bad, but this is worse than Kentucky. They interviewed one of my great aunts who was a cyclist. All the time the reporter mentions that these are all black people who don't show any resemblance of black. They look white. So that was something that he really specified. They had a hotel where they hung a man from, and this reporter went down there, I was told later, and he went to the hotel where the man had been hung at, and he was not there. And he asked around, where did you hang this man at? And they said, well, he's in a shed. Let me go get him, and we'll hang him back up so you can take a picture of him. So that's the picture that you see in this article that we have.
Yes, extremely cruel.
Oh, yeah. The governor sent a representative down there to ask him what went on down there, and the sheriff came up and said, oh, nothing happened. We got everything under control. And he went back to the governor and said, nothing happened. It says in the article that my great-grandmother had to sell her cow. She was moved to Springfield, called a refugee. She was allowed to come back free of charge by the train the next day and sell her cow. She got $10 for a cow that was probably worth six times that much. Mm-hmm. One guy was selling his chickens for 2 cents apiece. So this is what was happening. And then I did some investigative work on titles and who had the title and what happened to the title. The eight-room home that my family had was auctioned off on the courthouse steps for non-payment 1 month later, and they sold it for $175.
Mm-hmm. I'm almost speechless just to hear you just share the details that you found in the newspaper article. And where did you find that newspaper article?
Well, that's when Murray Bischoff, the managing editor of the Monet Times, who my brother went to, who had done research on this, but he couldn't get a foothold on it because everybody fought him down there. He was a transplant down there. He wasn't from that area. So he didn't have a real vested interest in the emotional part of the community. He was a news person. So he had heard that there was an article in St. Louis that existed. So he came up here and found it and brought it over to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the article restored where you could read it. So now I have a 30 by 38 size page of the article in vivid detail along with the pictures that went along with it.
Well, I have some questions that are coming out of the chat. Angela has asked several questions. One of them is, does the County Historical Society acknowledge this history?
That's a good question. They know it, but they don't acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see it written anywhere favorably for the people who had been expelled. All you hear that there was a problem in Pierce City in 1901.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you hear.
Now, did you go into the town to actually see where your ancestors lived?
Yes, the house still stands. The gentleman lives in the house now. I knocked on the door and said hi to him and told him that my family once lived here in 1901. And he was afraid of me. He thought I was going to start something with him.
Mm-hmm.
This was not on film. This was afterwards when I went back. I went back down there like three times. And the fourth time I went down there, that was my last visit because it wasn't a very good one.
It wasn't.
We had some problems that time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
If you ever see the film, you'll see the producer of the film sitting talking to the mayor, and you'll see outside of the window of the mayor's office a house, and that's the house my family lived in.
And did you take photos of the house?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. So does the town now claim to be integrated?
Well, you know, I told them that, well, I don't know if this person is still there. You know, they're one black citizen that they recruited. I called it the Hertz-Renner brother. You know, they went down to Neosho, Missouri, which is farther south towards Arkansas, and talked this guy into coming up to Pierce City. They also sent me a letter and told me that we are now a diverse town because we have a person in the junior queen contest who was 4 years old, whose mother is Caucasian and whose father is African-American. And when I found out later, this girl had got pregnant in college and came back home, and they were propping this child up as the model child and the prince of the town in 2006. And I told them no. That's when I told them they needed to bring people from a major community like St. Louis down there, set them up with a job, set them up with a home, and make them residents and get some government aid, and now I'll say that you are not the town of 1901.
Mm-hmm.
But their big thing about that town that made them proud to talk about was that they were descendants of the people who founded the town. So that means that they're no different than they were in 1901 or prior to 1901.
Right, right. So what is the population of this town now?
About 1,300. No, wait a minute. I don't really know. I know back then it was 1,300 and there were 300 blacks.
300 blacks. So it's a small black percentage-wise.
Well,
it's small black.
To the size of the town at that time,
mm-hmm.
that was a pretty good amount.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them were better economically. But, you know, similar to Rosewood, most of them were better economically because they pulled all their money together. And the two mills worked as Pullman porters on the railroad.
Yes, yes.
So they were better than the poor Caucasian people who were dirt farmers down there.
So if someone has to begin a journey such as your journey, what kind of tips would you want to leave with all of us tonight?
Well, the first thing I would say is never give up. When you start off, you're going to hit a brick wall. You might hit a brick wall the first time you research on the first person you find. If you find anybody that in a census record or on a farm and you go to another farm and you can't find anything, go back to that farm that you found somebody on for encouragement to come back. Because if you research and you don't find anything, now you'll go away, discuss it, and it's going to take a while for you to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And never think that you know the answer, because you don't. You have to find out and research and continue to research and ask questions and not take no for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
We could have taken no for an answer, and we'd have never got any of this accomplished.
Right. Yes. Perseverance.
Perseverance.
Mm-hmm. Perseverance. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing this story. I mean, it's heartbreaking. Your skills as a genealogist, clearly you did not give up, and your ancestors left footprints for you to follow. And it just seems as if everything started falling into place for you to really get to what that family secret was. So I want to really thank you so much, Charles, for sharing this story with us tonight. I'd like to just...
Can I have about 30 seconds?
You have 30 seconds.
Okay. We have a conference scheduled for the 18th of February in St. Louis. An all-day African-American genealogical conference. And Bernice probably didn't really want to say, but she's one of our keynote speakers. So it will be an all-day conference. It's very affordable. The information is on our website, which is www.stl-aahgs.com.
Would you say that again, please?
www.stl-aahgs.com. Now, we've only been in existence 3 years, but we hit the ground running. We haven't stopped yet. So I hope you can come and help take us to another level.
Well, thank you so very much. And I look forward to being a part of your conference. And hope we can talk a little bit more about those ancestors' footprints. Well, I'd like you to please join my guest next week. Kurt Witcher is going to come on and next week to describe the genealogical resources available at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Now, the Allen County Public Library Genealogy Center is a unique and valuable resource with one of the largest research collections available, incorporating records from around the world. So I hope that you will definitely join the show next week to hear Kurt Witcher. And then on January 26th, we have Gwendolyn Olson. Gwendolyn is going to describe the process of identifying and documenting slaves on the Lipscomb Plantation in Durham, North Carolina. And she has done just an excellent job documenting all of the slaves on this plantation. She's written an article, and there's an inn right now, the Lipscomb Plantation. There's an inn of which people can go and stay at this inn, and they have an opportunity to read about the residents. So I hope you will join me next week. So much is going on, and I really appreciate all of the people who have come on the show and have shared their history. And Charles, once again, I want to thank you so much. And if I don't have any questions from any of you in the chat, we'll close the show tonight. And I want to thank you again. And remember, your ancestors left footprints. And I think, Charles, you can definitely say your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you shall follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night.